a dry crust with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. Alexandra, thoughts?
Yes. In my French Bible.
Oh, it's on.
In my French Bible.
Better is a crouton. And then when we were watching Stissel, they were eating soup, and they called him croutonime. So that's all I have to say about that.
Okay. Rabbi Glenn?
Let's get Jerry in here to get this one going if we can. It's on. Okay, well, this is one of the many comparison statements in Proverbs. Better this than that. And strife and quarreling just puts a damper on everything. It's like an overwhelmingly negative experience, and it so overshadows us emotionally that we can't enjoy even the better things of life when we don't have that shalom. So better a few crumbs that digest well than a big steak dinner when you suffer indigestion because of unresolved conflict. So a tranquil home contributes to a healthy stomach.
I think that this is also highlighting that relationship is prime in the household. More important than your material wealth, more important than where you live or what you have, is how you relate to one another. And it's really true. It's important to God. It's important for quality of life, our relationships. Remember that's the priority. It really helps everything else fall into place.
So if we are wise men and wise women, we will prioritize our family relationships. That's what this is talking about. It's better to choose peace and quiet in your family with good relationships as your priority and work on your family relationships rather than striving for money and a bigger house and a more extravagant lifestyle and, your family suffers as a result. A good relationship with your family is better than wealth, better than status. That's what the wise man, the wise woman will choose and invest in. Verse 2, Alexandra, how about you reading it?
A prudent servant will rule over a disgraceful son and will share the inheritance as one of the family.
Thoughts?
I didn't write anything for that.
Martha?
Wisdom, a wise person trumps privilege.
I wrote that no one who has put in a lifetime of diligent work and wise planning would entrust their estate to a son or a daughter whose conduct is disgraceful and has diminished the honor of the family. Somebody like that would no doubt foolishly squander all the family's wealth, since a person like that doesn't have a sense of the value of things. They would much sooner bequeath their hard-earned wealth to a non-relative whose godly values match their own.
Wisdom is better than privilege. A wise servant is better than a disgraceful son. So wisdom is better than being born into privilege, and wisdom leads to success and prominence. If you conduct your life with wisdom, you may surpass those who are born with more advantages, with more privilege, but who lack wisdom. Verse 3, Rabbi Glenn.
The crucible for silver and the furnace for gold, but the Lord tests the heart.
Well, just like heat separates the impurities from the valuable silver and gold, the Lord's tests and trials, I think, are intended to do the same thing. He sees us as precious to begin with, and he wants to separate the impurities from us.
Yeah, I remember as a young kid watching for the first time an instructional movie in school about how metals are refined as part of the whole industrial thing, and watching them superheat it until it became liquid in form. And then they would scrape off all the dross that's on top. So human beings, we have intrinsic value, and so much more than the sum of our chemical components. But we come into this world like ore, having value, but in very rough form, dross-filled, as it were. So if we're to be useful and realize the purposes for which God gave us life and put us here, we need to submit ourselves to his refining process. But it's not pleasant sometimes, mm-hmm. but it's worth it.
It reminded me of a quote from C.S. Lewis. If there are rats in the cellar, you are most likely to see them if you go in very suddenly. But the suddenness does not create the rats. It only prevents them from hiding. In the same way, the suddenness of a provocation does not make me an ill-tempered man. It only shows me what an ill-tempered man I am. And it's like that testing of the heart. It's not, I mean, God knows what's there. It's just for our benefit to show us what's there. And then the test could be, like C.S. Lewis says, it's provocation or irritation or conflict. Or I think it's helpful to know that when we encounter those things, that's really a test. It's for our own good.
So the Lord wants to refine us, and we need refining, so expect the heat to be turned up from time to time. Expect trials, difficulties, challenges. Don't be resentful when they happen. It's part of God's refining process. Cooperate with it. That's what the wise man, the wise woman will do.
Sure. Just one more comment. And he does it precisely because he loves us. He loves us too much to leave us as we are. Derek Kidner wrote this: his trials are constructive, not for finding a person out, but for sorting him out.
Mm-hmm. Verse 6. Children's children are a crown to the aged, and parents are the pride of their children.
Well, Zoe and Adam are just one of the biggest joys. And, you know, it says a crown. I looked at the definition. It represents power, legitimacy, victory, triumph, honor, glory, and immortality. And I never thought of Zoe and Adam in that way, but I know that they give us so much joy.
Okay. I wish both of these statements were always the case. The psychological interdependence between generations is a very real thing. And we should derive joy from one another if we're living well. For me, the first statement absolutely holds true. I delight to be Papa. and I feel elation and a certain sense of accomplishment to see my own children growing up and now beginning to have children of their own. What I'm less certain of is that I am a source of pride for them. Maybe it's a sign of the times in which we live. Sometimes I feel like I'm an embarrassment to them. So I tend to think this second statement is a little more conditional. It really depends on the level of maturity of your children, where they're at spiritually, where you're at spiritually. I mean, I would hope that our children will be proud of us, especially if our lives are consistent with what we claim to believe.
Yeah, I do see that second part of the verse, parents are pride to their children, as a challenge. Parents, myself, make your children proud. Work at it. But you don't have to work at the children's children being a crown. That is one of the amazing gifts that God gives us. Just his design. I was taken by storm when Lily was born. I never imagined that it would feel more like falling in love. It's such a special gift, grandparenthood, and it's right from God's hand.
Verse 7, eloquent lips are unsuited to a godless fool. How much worse, lying lips to a ruler. Okay.
Well, this made me think about how much power rulers have over our lives. Like, it's one thing if somebody wants to be foolish and talk nonsense, but it's a lot worse when you have an authority that can change laws that affect the way we live.
Things are so bad in our society that we're no longer even shocked to discover that we've been lied to by our leaders. And I use that word in the plural intentionally, because as far as I'm concerned, we don't live in a constitutional republic anymore. I've come to think that we're living more like in an unofficial oligarchy with a corrupt elite class of very powerful leaders, agency directors, executives, cabinet members who lie almost as naturally as they breathe, and they seem to get away with it. They seem exempt from the laws that apply to the rest of us. It's really a shame, and that's what verse 7 is saying. It's really shameful for a ruler to be characterized by dishonesty.
People are attracted to those who speak eloquently. It's particularly destructive when godless fools, men and women who reject... more people. And we have a lot of leaders who are godless fools, Republicans and Democrats and as well. But their lives are particularly destructive. So we need honest leaders who speak the truth. And we also need a microphone that works properly. Testing.
Channel 4.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Thank you, Herman. Verse 8. A bribe is seen as a charm by the one who gives it. They think success will come at every turn. Alexandra, any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I thought. It strikes me that the person who gives a bribe is assuming widespread corruption. And it's interesting that so many thousands of years ago and now that seems to be the case.
Donna, this other one is Elaine's, so whatever channel she was. 5? Okay. Can you hold that, Martha? That'll be channel 5. What this is describing is quid pro quo. Not a legitimate purchase of an item, but rather an unethical or illegal transaction where money or favors are given, but expecting that some specific thing is going to be done in return. An example would be the head of a drug cartel paying a police chief and or a mayor money to look the other way, like when some big shipment is coming in or something like that. Sadly, in our broken, sinful world, bribes often work. Justice is often perverted. But sometimes, just every so often, a bribe is offered to the wrong person, an honest and principled person, and it backfires. Because bribes only work on corrupt people. So let's make sure that that's not us. And since a bribe is a temptation, let's face it, we could all use a little more cash in our wallets. But since a bribe is a temptation, it's important that we have our boundaries in place before the temptation comes.
I guess this isn't working either. Oh, it is, okay. I have seen in Proverbs, and it was confusing to me until really looked at it this week, there seem to be two kinds of bribes. good bribes and bad bribes. And what we've just been talking about are the bad bribes, when justice is perverted and, influencing for the wrong reasons. But there is another kind of bribe that's described that's a good bribe. Lauren, you want to talk about that?
Well, it's more like a gift. There have been a couple of instances where someone has been hurt or offended by something I've done or said, and I have done something generous, financially or in other ways, and that's really made a very positive impact to help restore that relationship. Would I call it a bribe? I mean, no, I would call it a gift, but it's a gift that's used in a positive way to help a relationship. A negative bribe is used to pervert justice.
And Lauren had demonstrated it to me in the past couple of years. I've seen him do a good bribe.
Can we just call it like gift? A good, not a good bribe.
Well, I'll give one example. There was a neighbor who was offended, and he went and he gave them a gift. He gave them a restaurant. They went to a restaurant on it, and it turned the relationship around. It was remarkable, and their attitude has been wonderful ever since.
Verse 9, whoever would foster love covers over an offense, but whoever repeats the matter separates close friends.
Well, it got me thinking, like, how do you cover over an offense? Because I know, like, for me, if I'm offended about something, I tend to dwell on it and think about it and think about it. So I think I was thinking that maybe you could just bounce your mind away from it. Like, okay, that's a temptation to think about it. And of course, it's a temptation to repeat it and get somebody to agree how offensive the offense was. But those are both things we must avoid.
I wrote that this shouldn't be confused with protecting somebody who has done something that's criminal or done something truly shameful for which they deserve punishment. I think this is a warning really against gossiping about a person, which destroys friendships. And it is something the Lord detests, by the way, Proverbs 6. Fostering love here, the way I was looking at it, I think means affording the wrongdoer the opportunity to privately, quietly, repent and make restitution, to afford the person who has done wrong the dignity of making things right without everybody else having to hear about what they did.
I like that.
And I think that it also helps us to see that focusing on the relationship being more important than the offense, and making that the priority over I was right and they were wrong.
If you love someone, you want to forgive that person and you want to protect that person. So if you love someone, you choose to be forgiving and you try to protect them and not spread his sin to others. Those who aren't loving, who aren't forgiving, repeat a matter and thereby damage relationships. I remember someone who was part of the congregation who really did not like me. He did not love me. And he looked for every opportunity to expose whatever offenses he thought I was guilty of, and even maybe invent some offenses that I wasn't guilty of and spread that as well. We want to be the opposite of that. Love covers over, forgives, protects, tries to keep the circle limited as far as information. Verse 10, a rebuke impresses a discerning person more than 100 lashes a fool. Rabbi Glenn, how about if we start with you this time?
Okay. I wrote that few things are more lamentable than an unteachable person. And that's in large part what characterizes a fool, the refusal to either receive instruction or correction. But assuming he or she, this person assumes that they know enough, that you can't teach them, nobody can tell them anything. And, I mean, nobody relishes being rebuked, but there are times that we need it. And if we're wise, we'll welcome that process of correction because we know that something greater is on the other side of it. Shalom results from it. The writer of Hebrews talked about that. All discipline for the moment seems not to be pleasant, but unpleasant, but to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness.
Martha?
I'm wondering if this isn't also encouraging us, once we realize someone is unteachable and a fool, if 100 lashes isn't going to help them, why should we even waste time trying to rebuke them? Mm-hmm. Whereas a wise person who's worth investing in, just one rebuke, and that's all that's needed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in our culture, I've just been noticing that we tend to treat intelligence as a virtue, and it's really not a virtue, because somebody can be wise and discerning with any degree of IQ. I mean, IQ, they're just geniuses that are fools, and it really struck me that a fool can be intelligent but impervious to correction.
People don't like correction. The wise make themselves listen to correction, receive correction. They are easy to correct. Fools don't listen to correction and are virtually impossible to correct. So we want to force ourselves to receive correction, to be open to correction. Rabbi Glenn, how about if you read verse 12?
Better to meet a bear robbed of her cubs than a fool bent on folly.
Thoughts?
I love that imagery. Mama bear is dangerous if you try to take her cub away. And to say that that's how a fool is, if you try to come between the fool and his folly, to me is a warning to stay away from trying to correct a fool. They're dangerous, not just, oh, they're so foolish. No, they're dangerous. Stay away.
The fool will take you down with him. Walk away. Run if necessary. A mama bear might inflict great harm on you, but even a bear might have the sense to stop once you're no longer a threat. The fool doesn't know when to stop, and if you get entangled with such a person, it can have far-reaching consequences.
I think you guys said it all.
Fools are dangerous. A fool can be as protective of his stupid and destructive ideas and plans as much as a mother bear is protective of her cubs. I think of today's godless politicians who are fools bent on folly with these incredibly stupid, dangerous, godless ideas. Better to meet a bear robbed of her cubs than a foolish politician bent on folly. Alexandra, 14.
Starting a quarrel is like breaching a dam, so drop the matter before a dispute breaks out.
Thoughts?
If someone else wants to start a quarrel, don't engage. I'm trying to read my writing. Change the subject.
When a conflict is in its early stages, don't escalate the conflict. Try to de-escalate the conflict. Try to be a peacemaker. Try to avoid quarrels and disputes, if at all possible, because they can take on a destructive life of its own. Rabbi Glenn?
From this I got, choose your battles very, very carefully. Is it really worth the trouble and the time and the flurry of emails to get into it with someone? What is the nature of the contention? Some fights are worth having, but history is replete with men and women making mountains out of molehills. And honestly, even if you've been wronged, does it rise to the level of starting a quarrel? Do you have the self-control to let it go?
And the very advice of choosing your battles implies be prepared, just expect that there are a lot of battles in life that you need to walk away from.
All right, I want to skip to 17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for a time of adversity. Alexandra.
It struck me that not all siblings are friends with each other. We may have really close friends. I know in my life I'm much closer with my friends than with my brother and sister. And when we get together, you know, some of us are on one very liberal Buddhist side of things, and some of us are like us. So there's not a lot in common, but my parents have been ill, and my brother and sister and I are getting together and talking with each other and texting, and there's a real community there. And I don't call my friends to get in and bring meals to my parents, but it's really been an eye-opener for this proverb.
Rabbi Glenn.
Adversity is what tests the bonds of family and friendships. You find out who your real friends are when you're in need or in trouble, when you need help. And those who can't be inconvenienced or who are tight-fisted with money or what have you, they're not friends. Their love is as seasonal as the snowbirds who flee the Midwest during the winter.
We have a few snowbirds here, so be careful.
Well, no, there's nothing wrong with that. The point is that the person who only is your friend when everything's good and sunny and lovely in your life, but who is nowhere to be found when trouble comes, it shows that they were not a real friend.
Marth?
I love that God's designed family to be there during adverse times, and it's a reminder we want to be that kind of family. We want to be there for our family during adverse times. And a friend loves at all times. This is a kind of loyalty that you should look for before you really trust a friend. There's all kinds of friends, but loyal friends, they're few and far between.
And sometimes, Rabbi Lorne, you're surprised by who proves to be a friend. Somebody maybe that you really wouldn't have figured would rise to the occasion, comes to your help when you need it. So sometimes you find out who your truest friends are when things are rough. I was thinking of King David when he had to flee from Jerusalem in humiliation during the Absalom rebellion. Who turned out to be one of his most loyal supporters was a guy who was actually from Philistia, Ittai, the Gittite. I mean, who would have figured? Where was everybody else in his hour of need? And here this foreigner showed more loyalty and support to David than anybody.
Choose loyal friends, not fair weather friends. And you only need a few good friends in life. You don't need 10 friends, 20 friends. And Facebook friends are not what this proverb is describing. Did you get to say something? Okay. How about, Alexandra, you read verse 18, a little bit of financial wisdom.
One who has no sense shakes hands in pledge and puts up security for a neighbor.
Any thoughts?
It's just, you know, prudence is common sense and that practical wisdom, and here it says it's just not prudent or wise or sensical to put up pledge for somebody else's debt.
Which means be careful about guaranteeing other people's debts, other people's liabilities, right? Be very careful, very cautious. Rabbi Glenn?
Well, the NLT renders it this way, and I thought it was kind of cool. It is poor judgment to co-sign a friend's note to become responsible for a neighbor's debt. And why is it foolish? Because your neighbor isn't likely to have a dramatic reformation. And so whatever, you know, got him into a debt problem is probably going to keep him there, only now you're on the hook too.
Exactly.
And I think that we should take this verse as an encouragement to not feel guilty when we say no to somebody who's asking for financial help.
Let's move on to verse 20. One whose heart is corrupt does not prosper. One whose tongue is perverse falls into trouble. Rabbi Glenn, thoughts?
Just briefly, that despite occasional exceptions to this, ultimately this will prove true. And we have to have an eternal perspective, you know, in reading these Proverbs, lest we think that, well, this certainly fails because there's plenty of corrupt people who do prosper. But ultimately this will prove true. There will be no place in the millennial kingdom for the perverse. And then in eternity, judgment awaits those.
Alexandra?
Well, I looked up perverse, and there's a lot of words, you know, awkward, corrupt, difficult, unreasonable, uncooperative, unhelpful, disobedient, obstreperous, vexatious. And the thing is, even if they're prospering on the outside, a person like that does not have the joy of the Lord, the peace that passes understanding.
Marth?
I think in the end, it does catch up with us in this life if we live that way with a corrupt heart and a perverse tongue. It does catch up with you.
God loves truth and he loves honesty. You can get ahead by cheating and lying, but often those benefits will be short-lived. And in the end, those who are corrupt and lie so easily will have trouble. I remember reading a statistic that something like 75% of high school, college students are willing to cheat on tests. A huge percentage of the population is willing to cheat on their spouses. We're living in a time of real corruption, lack of integrity as a society, low morals. God's calling us to a much better standard, and the wise man, the wise woman will really strive to be honest and truthful men and women of integrity.
I think one more insight is that sometimes it takes time to get to know people. Don't be so quick to trust. Just give yourself space and time to watch a person, because eventually it will show, but not at first. It may look good.
Verse 22. Alexandra, why don't you read it?
A cheerful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. And I know over the times that we've done this, we've talked about the mind-body-spirit connection, but this really gave me more questions this time reading it, because if you have a crushed spirit, or you're in distress or affliction or pain, I mean, how do you get a cheerful heart? It just doesn't seem like... If it's good medicine, how do you make the medicine? Is there a compounding pharmacist with a recipe to get a cheerful heart?
Martha?
Good point, Alexandra. And I do think that apart from the joy of the Lord being our strength and discovering that for a reality in our own life, a consistently cheerful heart is impossible.
Well, To an extent, our focus determines our outlook about things. If, you know, there are some things about which you have no control. If you're sick or if a loved one has passed away, if circumstances are, to an extent, you have to go through some of this. But sometimes I think we stew about things we didn't need to. And we work ourselves up about things we didn't need to, and we're doing it to ourselves. I put that there is a direct relationship between our emotional well-being and our physical state. Protracted distress or depression does tend to weaken the immune system and makes us vulnerable to getting sick. You know, part of my own recovery from cancer when I was in my 20s included humor. I went out of my way to find things about which I could laugh. I would watch a funny show. And generally, I learned that it's in our best interest to seek out people of good cheer and of goodwill. So discernment about our associations can factor into this, and just our focus helps determine our outlook. If we don't have to stew over unnecessary things, let it go.
The joy of the Lord is our strength and also our health. A cheerful heart is good medicine. So we need our happiness not to be dependent on our circumstances, but on our hope, on the promises of God. We need to be reminding ourselves of our hope, the source of our joy, the source of our happiness. And that's good medicine for us. Martha, why don't you read verse 24?
A discerning person keeps wisdom in view, but a fool's eyes wander to the ends of the earth. I think this is talking about focus, and a discerning person will stay focused on the priorities, focused on wisdom, or as the fool is not focused. They're looking at this, that, and the other, the next scheme, the next dream. They're unstable. They're all over the place.
I wrote, don't drop your guard. There's a line from a beloved hymn, one of my favorite hymns, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. And the line goes like this, prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the one I love. Here's my heart. Oh, take and seal it for thy courts above. You know, a person with discernment understands how fickle our nature is and how we are so easily distracted by this, that, and the other thing, how prone we are to go off the rails spiritually. So if we're discerning, we'll just be aware of that tendency and ask the Lord to keep us on that straight and narrow.
I like that.
No, I think you covered it.
I agree. Verse 25, a foolish son brings grief to his father and bitterness to the mother who bore him.
Well, I thought about what a risk it is having a child in this world, because there's no guarantee that they're going to choose to love God or love us or live a good life. But also, you know, it's a picture of God. He made all of us, and there's no guarantee that all of his creatures are going to love him or choose the right way.
Glenn?
What comes to mind is that you hope your kids will be wise, but ultimately it's out of our hands. We do the best we can to instill godly values in them, but ultimately it's in the Lord's hands. But you know, you could wish. I almost feel like the author of this proverb was writing this not for the parents but for the younger people. What kind of son or daughter am I going to be?
In our culture, the attitude it seems to be, it's your life, it's your decision, it's nobody else's business. And this says, What you choose affects everybody around you. It affects your family. It's not just you. It's not just your business. And if it affects us, we have a right to say something too.
Foolish children bring grief and bitterness to their parents, so parents, do everything you possibly can to fill your children with wisdom, with the Bible, with the gospel, with truth, with virtue. And yet, in spite of doing that, some children will reject wisdom and be fools. Verse 27, the one who has knowledge uses words with restraint, and whoever has understanding is even-tempered. Martha.
I think that this is a picture of what self-control is supposed to look like. When you want to say what you're thinking and feeling, and you choose to restrain yourself and maintain even-temperedness, even though you might feel upset inside.
Rabbi Glenn?
I choose restraint here.
No, I agree with Martha.
It's hard to think before you speak, to think before you act, to think before you give into anger, but that's what the wise man, the wise woman learns to do, and we need to be filled with the Holy Spirit, and we need the grace of God. The fruit of the Spirit is self-control. The one who has knowledge uses words with restraint. So we need the help of the Holy Spirit. We need God's grace to maintain self-control, to think before we speak or act. Verse 28, our last one for today, similar to 27. Even fools are thought wise if they keep silent, and discerning if they hold their tongues.
I wasn't going to say anything about this one.
That would make you wise.
I know. But it did strike me that sometimes we might have opinions about things that we don't really know a lot about, and if we spout those opinions in front of people who do know a lot about that subject, it really it ruins our credibility. And when we do want to speak about something we know about, like Jesus and the gospel, they might not respect our opinion, so we need to be careful.
Somebody made a movie years back, and I can't for the life of me remember the name of it. But it's this guy, I don't know if he was just homeless or whatever, just some strange guy, and he wouldn't talk. But everybody around him, as he starts being introduced into these ever more...
Being there with Peter Sellers, one of my favorite
movies.
Was Chauncey the Gardener.
Mm-hmm. Right. He wouldn't talk, and people thought he was so brilliant.
He would only talk about gardening, and people...
They thought he was so deep.
Speaking
profound, and yeah, it's a great movie.
That's the extent of my insight on this verse.
I think 28 is an exclamation point on 27. Yeah. Restrain your tongue.
Think before you speak. Restrain your words. You'll be wiser for it. Thank you, Martha, Rabbi Glenn, Alexandra, for this discussion on Proverbs 17. Yeah, if